It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we talk to Wisconsin State Senator Fred Risser about the proposed revamp of the civil service system here in the state.
First, according to some sources, Paul Ryan is open to running for Speaker of the House. The House doesn't return to Washington from recess until Tuesday evening, but people close to Ryan are reporting that he is considering launching a bid for Speaker.
The caveat is that he'd only do it if he's ensured near unanimous support from House Republicans, including the Freedom Caucus. The Freedom Caucus in large part derailed Kevin McCarthy's bid for Speaker by refusing to support him.
Here with us now is David Cannon, professor of political science at UW-Madison. David, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
So until the last day or so, the story was that Paul Ryan, not that into the idea of being Speaker of the House. It would take some arm twisting to get him there. What might have changed his mind between then and now?
Well, actually, if you read the fine print of what his supporters are saying, it really hasn't changed that much. I mean, basically, he's still saying that he wants a unanimous or near unanimous vote. So I think that might have shifted a little bit. He used to be saying unanimous, now he's saying near unanimous. But the other crucial thing, and this is coming from several reports I've seen online where they're quoting, you know, Ryan's insiders, his confidants, is the way the reports are putting it, is he's still saying apparently that he will not agree to any preconditions. And right now, basically, the Freedom Caucus has a whole list of conditions that they'll be asking any prospective member of the House who's running for Speaker, including some fairly specific policy things like Planned Parenthood funding, but also general rule changes in terms of like how a discharge petition would work. And Ryan has been quite clear, again, speaking through his supporters, that he would not agree to any of those kinds of preconditions before signing on to be Speaker. And if he stays with that position, it seems unlikely to me the Freedom Caucus would go along with that, at least given their publicly stated positions in the past week or so.
Well, what does that seem to signify to you that a would-be Speaker of the House would say to the Freedom Caucus, no conditions, I'm not agreeing to anything ahead of time, I'm not going to negotiate? What does that seem to indicate about what kind of Speaker he'd be and what kind of relationship that he might have with the Freedom Caucus?
Well, I completely agree with Representative Ryan that he needs to do that, because basically he would be signaling to the Freedom Caucus that they could pretty much run the show if he did anything else. And as Speaker, you're governing the entire institution, you know, not just the party. And that's what got John Boehner in trouble, is that, you know, on things like the debt ceiling, he worked with Democrats to get that done. And Paul Ryan, I think, knows that he's going to be in that same position of having to work with the Democrats to get things like increasing the debt ceiling done. And so if he would limit himself ahead of time to saying that he wouldn't work with the Democrats on anything, you know, basically they want, one condition of the Freedom Party is to abide formally by the Hastert rule, which says you won't go ahead with anything unless you have a majority of House Republicans in favor of it. And so, you know, he would be really tying himself in a bind if he agreed to those kinds of preconditions. So I think that any Speaker needs to make it clear that, look, I can't agree to some of these things in advance. It would make it impossible for me to govern the institution.
But would that be binding? Would it be the sort of thing where you could agree to now just to get the Speaker installed and then, you know, negotiate the terms as you go along?
Well, yeah, I mean, that puts you in a very tough spot then of having broken your word, with the Freedom Caucus. And I think that would be grounds for a revolt then, the way that they have revolted against John Boehner and then McCarthy as well. And so I think Ryan wants to be able to listen to his party, certainly, and listen to their concerns, but not to pre-commit himself to any specific positions ahead of time.
Does Paul Ryan have this kind of leverage right now to make these sorts of statements? I mean, there was a lot of hand-wringing when we learned that he was leading toward this position, and there was that open slot there that was not being filled. So does he have this power right now?
Well, I think he does, just because there are not a lot of other options out there right now for the Republican Party in terms of anyone else who would have anything like this level of support. While, you know, there still are people who are you know, speaking out against Paul Ryan. Just today, I think it was Stephen King was saying that he was going to oppose a possible candidacy of Paul Ryan because of his position on immigration. So I think you'll have some immigration hardliners who might be opposed to Ryan. So, you know, there'll be some opposition, but no one else comes even close to the level of support that Paul Ryan has. And that's why I think he does have a very strong bargaining position right now in terms of the limited options that the party has.
We're talking right now to David Cannon, professor of political science at UW-Madison, talking about the news that Paul Ryan may be open to the idea of running for Speaker of the House. And one big question was, you know, whether if Paul Ryan were to assume this role as Speaker of the House, whether it would hurt his chances down the road for a bigger political career, maybe even a presidential bid. Do you think he's come to any sort of terms with that question?
Well, that is a very good question. And the other thing related to just, you know, Paul Ryan's overall career ambitions, he has his dream job right now, at least according to, again, to him and to his supporters. Being chair of the Ways and Means Committee is something that he has wanted for a very long time, because his, you know, big interests are in economic policy, tax policy. That's what Ways and Means Committee does. And so that's another thing that gives him that kind of bargaining position right now, is that he doesn't really want the job. You know, so it's, you know, if they want him, they're going to have to come to his terms, not the other way around. And presidential ambitions, I agree that that would be another thing that could be damaged by serving as Speaker, because it's so difficult to run the House right now with the Freedom Caucus, you know, taking the position, such a strong position on, you know, such a broad range of issues where they, you know, basically refuse to compromise with Democrats.
You mentioned that Ryan is chair of the House Ways and Means Committee. Would he be able to keep on doing that, continue that work, if he were Speaker?
No, absolutely not. No, he'd have to give up his position as chair of Ways and Means. Now, one thing he might be able to negotiate, though, and this is one thing, and I haven't heard any of his people talk about this, but what he could potentially agree to, you know, and set the conditions would be, okay, I'll do this for, you know, X amount of time, you know, 1 year or whatever, and then when I'm done, I get to go back to being chair of Ways and Means Committee, which would be outside the normal process for doing that. But he probably could negotiate that ahead of time if he, you know, wanted to be assured he could go back to that position.
So you've got Paul Ryan, who says he's already doing his dream job. He's not that into this idea. He likes his work as chair of the House Ways and Means Committee. So aside from this being a position of power, what else is there to entice Ryan to do this?
Well, he's a very loyal Republican. I mean, he really is a good team player. He cares a lot about the Republican Party in the House. And I think he, you know, wants to listen to the leaders of the party and you know, help out the party potentially, you know, if he can, and if he can, you know, come to terms that are agreeable to him. I mean, I think he would probably be willing to do it for those reasons, you know, that he is a good, loyal Republican, and he doesn't want to see his party suffering. In fact, there just was a poll that came out today in the Washington Post that showed that by a margin of 2-1, the American public sees the GOP leadership right now in the House as, you know, dysfunctional, and even, you know, about an even split between Republicans are saying that they don't support what's going on in the Republican Party in the House right now. And so I think, you know, Ryan sees that his party is in trouble right now, and I think he would like to be able to help them out if he thinks that, you know, there are reasonable conditions for him taking the job.
And what does the Republican Party do if Ryan doesn't want the job or take the job?
Boy, that is a really good question, and if I knew the answer to that, I would be able. I mean, no one knows the answer to that question. It's a really impossible position for them right now. I mean, I think one scenario would be a series of, you know, many, many, many votes where it ends up being deadlocked, where different candidates would be running, you know, and different factional interests supporting a more moderate and then a more conservative Republican, and no one emerging with a majority after dozens of votes. And if that were to happen and there was a true deadlock, it's conceivable that, you could go back to McCarthy or Ryan or someone like that and get them elected on a bipartisan vote, where you'd get, you know, many Republicans voting with Democrats to elect someone like McCarthy. I mean, that's never happened in the history of the U.S. House. It's happened a few times in state legislatures. California did it once. I believe North Carolina did it once, where they, you know, didn't have agreement within the majority party on who to pick, and so you had a coalition, a bipartisan coalition. I think that's extremely unlikely right now, but that is something, if it gets to be really bad and we have a true deadlock, that is at least a theoretical possibility. Now, a third option, and this is even less likely, I think, some have pointed out, you don't actually have to be a House member to be the Speaker of the House. This was a, you know, we hear about drafting errors in legislation that, you know, happen all the time. Well, this is kind of a drafting error at the Constitutional Convention, where I'm sure the founders didn't really want to make that possible, but they didn't say it wasn't possible. And so it's conceivable someone like a Newt Gingrich could come back and be Speaker. And there have been some pundits that have actually suggested that. Again, I think that's extremely unlikely. But if we had a complete deadlock situation, you know, it's possible they could even do something like that.
So we're also closing in on the deadline for raising the debt limit. Is that going to hold Ryan's feet or the House's feet to the fire in any way?
Well, I think, I mean, Boehner has agreed to stick around as long as they, you know, don't have a Speaker. So I think what will happen, so, I mean, here is one possible outcome, is you have John Boehner stick around long enough to get the debt ceiling increased, and again, passing that with, you know, largely Democratic votes, and then some Republicans will be willing to do it. And then once Boehner's done the dirty work on that, then maybe Ryan could step in without, you know, many other preconditions and be the Speaker for the, you know, the rest of this term at least.
David, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, good to be with you.
That was David Cannon, professor of political science at UW-Madison. We're talking about news that Paul Ryan may be open to the idea of running for Speaker of the House. Republican lawmakers are pursuing an overhaul of the state's civil service system. The new plan would eliminate exams and seniority protections, centralize hiring, and make it easier to fire misbehaving employees.
Democrats, many of them, oppose that move. It was actually Democratic Senator Fred Risser's grandfather, a Republican, who sponsored the existing civil service laws back in 1905. Senator Risser joins us now. Welcome to Central Time.
Welcome, and thank you for having me on.
So by most hiring and firing standards in private businesses today, the state civil service looks kind of rigid, a little old-fashioned, not up with the times, and not quick-moving. Do you think there's a case to be made for making some kind of changes to it, even if not the ones being proposed?
Well, I think there's always opportunity for revision in statutes, yes. And I think some improvements could be made. But I think that the hiring of public servants should be based on what they know rather than who they know. The problem with this bill is it turns hiring of state employees into a patronage system because it centralizes the hiring in the governor's hands.
So what is the advantage of having the civil service exam, for example, in place for prospective state employees to take, as opposed to, you know, a resume and references and the sort of things other people do for jobs?
Because a exam is far fairer than a resume. You have a resume reviewed by a board. They can blacklist you for just about anything. For instance, they could analyze and see whether you signed a recall petition against the governor. In fact, they did that in the case of a student regent. A student regent was appointed by the governor. He found out that the regent had signed a recall petition, and he changed his mind. We don't want that kind of activity on the part of the governor.
I mentioned that it was your grandfather who had helped pass the current civil service system. It has changed somewhat in the last century or so. Can you look back at that history, talk about what he and others were trying to put in place then?
Yes, I'm honored by that. My grandfather, my mother's father, Ernest Warner, was in the state assembly back in 1905. He was a La Follette Republican at the time, and he introduced a bill February 2nd, 1905, to develop the civil service system in Wisconsin. And that bill passed on a bipartisan effort and is the basis for Wisconsin civil service, one of the first civil service acts in the entire United States. Other states followed it. And it's undergone revision, and it should undergo revision. But to turn around and do away with exams, do away with the hiring of people on the basis of what they know rather than who they know, I think is a mistake.
Was at that time, 1905, was the perception or maybe the reality that we were hiring civil servants as a patronage system rather than on qualifications?
Absolutely. This was the beginning of the progressive reform. My grandfather, Ernest Warner, was a member of the progressive wing of the Republican Party at the time. And as you remember your history, that's the beginning of the La Follette era, and it was an era in which they attacked the patronage system that then existed. And a number of progressive reforms were made at that time, and civil service was one of them.
The idea, I think, behind the Republican legislation is that this is a different time than when that law was passed. Patronage isn't really the way things are done. There would be oversight. There would be checks and balances in place to make sure this wasn't just a giveaway for whichever party happened to control the government at the time. For example, Republicans passing it now, they know that someday Democrats might control the levers of hiring.
You know, I hate to see our government come into a situation where when the Republicans come in, all the Republican people are elected there, made civil servants, and when the Democrats come in, the Democrats select theirs. This opens up the opportunity for out-and-out corruption, and it certainly encourages patronage. After all, the way this bill is written, the governor, through a board that he controls, would analyze these various resumes, and they could determine on the basis of subjective reviews whether that person should take the job or not. It doesn't make any difference whether he or she was qualified. It's just whether the review board wanted to accept them. We don't want to go back to those days. And while the civil service system isn't perfect and could stand revision, it's far better than an out-and-out patronage system, which existed back in 1905 and is in the possibility of coming in existence again.
Talking to Democratic State Senator Fred Risser from Madison, looking at Republican proposals to change Wisconsin's civil service system, how many state employees are hired, and how they're fired, Senator Risser, another change that Republicans are looking for, changes the definition of when somebody can be fired, a just cause. And the idea is, they say, it's too hard to fire someone, even for fairly egregious on-the-job issues.
Well, I don't think that's the case. People are fired and can be fired at any time for any reason the first 6 months of their employment. Now, the Republican bill would say you have that up to 2 years to fire a person without cause. I don't think that makes sense. As I say, at the present time, there is a probationary period of 6 months. This bill would change that time from 6 months to 2 years. During that probationary period, an employer could discharge an employee for any cause without reason. And I think that just adds to the corruption possibilities in this case.
One concern is that as baby boomers get older, we're going to be having a lot of public employees in various lines of work retiring in the coming years. We're going to need to replace them. The current system is just too slow. The case is being made that it takes months and months to hire people. Good people find other jobs in the meantime. Would at least the Republican proposals streamline things, make it easier, faster to hire people for these jobs?
Actually, this bill does require that after a person is certified that he or she be notified faster than currently. And I think that's a good idea. I don't think a person should be dangling forever. And there are some good points to the bill. I won't say the bill is 100% wrong, but I just say the overall thrust of the bill is to promote patronage and open the doors for corruption.
Well, if we were to tackle civil service reforms the way that many public employees are hired and fired, what would be the right way to do it, do you think? What would you like to see as far as process and maybe as far as policy changes?
Well, I think what has to be done is, first of all, you have to have a study of the whole process. You can't put it together in one bill. You know, this bill was introduced October 1st, and they want to have action on it right away. Now, that's too fast. You can't change a system of 60,000 people inside of less than a month. And the haste of which this bill is being handled is also questionable. As I say, it was just introduced on October 1st. Then on October 6th, less than 1 week after it's introduced, they have a hearing. In other words, they have a hearing on this 40-page bill before anyone's had a chance to really review it. And that's not exactly the best way of going at a problem such as a civil service. I think it needs a study. I think a legislative council study of the civil service system would be a good idea. And I think in such a study you would invite employers and employees and various people to participate, and they could come up with ideas to improve the program. We have a system of legislative council activity, and we should use it. We use it in other cases, and we should use it in this case. But don't forget, this bill was just introduced October 1st, and they want to ram it through already without giving people a full chance to review it.
As we wrap up, given that Republicans have a majority in both chambers, is it a foregone conclusion? Do you think this is just going to happen more or less as it's written?
I'm not so sure, and the reason I say that is that we're going to have an executive session on this bill. Last week it was announced, and then all of a sudden the chairman of the committee pulled the bill off the executive session list, which means the committee did not act on it as fast as he anticipated. So possibly the hearing, which lasted almost 12 hours, brought out some things, and people will take a little closer look at this. You can't revise the whole system inside of a month. And I think, there's always a chance for improvement. You've got to go at it the right way.
Senator Risser, thanks for joining us today.
You bet.
That was State Senator Fred Risser from Madison talking about his opposition to a proposed overhaul of Wisconsin's civil service system. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Fall's a great time to get outside, and our next guest has some extra motivation for us. He says there's a lot of joy to be had in collecting stuff from the natural world that tells a story and gives us a sense of wonder. Maybe that means seashells on the beach or feathers in the woods or maybe a fossil in a pile of rocks.
From an early age, Gordon Grice has been collecting unique artifacts in nature and displaying them in his cabinet of curiosities. Now in a new book, he's sharing his advice on how you can start your own, and he talks about the joy it can bring kids and adults.
Gordon Grice joins us now. He's a Wisconsin-based nature writer and author of the new book, Cabinet of Curiosities, Collecting and the Understanding the Wonders of the Natural World. Gordon, thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Gordon, so these Cabinet of Curiosities, they go back a long time. People have been fascinated with these things they find in the natural world for a long time throughout history. So how has this idea changed over time?
It really started with the ancient Romans, as far as we can sort of nail down. As a religious use, where the collections would occur in temples devoted to specific gods. So the Oracle at Delphi, for example, had a group of curiosities associated with it. But what really sort of brought it into modern times was in the Age of Exploration, when Europeans were exploring and sometimes exploiting other parts of the world and bringing back especially biological specimens that they didn't know what to make of. And so it was a huge impetus to the science of the time, but also to just sort of the average person's curiosity about what existed out there in the world.
Well, your Age of Exploration, I understand, started around age six. Gordon, can you tell us about the first Cabinet of Curiosities you put together?
For me, it started with a cigar box, which was what my mom found for me because my dad smoked cigars. And I just kept bringing in things that interested me that I found on our farm. And so, for example, I found a skunk skull. I don't recommend that every kid handle something like that, mm-hmm. but I did. And just interesting items like that. We had wild pumpkins in the area where I grew up, and that was this kind of a neat little gourd-like seed pod that will last for years. And so just interesting things that caught my fancy and that I wanted to keep all went into this little cigar box until my collection got too big for it.
What are some of the most unusual things that have gone into these cabinets of curiosity over the years?
Human mummies, for one thing. We still there are federal laws now to prevent most of this happening, but over history there was a great interest in mummified human bodies, and so this was a rich source of research. And you'd see bodies, especially from the American Southwest, where the arid conditions would naturally preserved bodies at times, and also from the Inca culture, where there was some attempt to preserve them on purpose. So that's one thing that went in. Another interesting kind of specimen was the teratological specimen, or freaks, as they called them. So two-headed human babies, or animals that were born with too many limbs, and you know, some really gruesome sorts of things over time were turned up in these collections.
Now, in your own cabinets, and the ones you're suggesting that people do, I think you're having people look a little closer to home and less into that unusual territory. Why try to find this sense of wonder in the animals, vegetables, and minerals in the world around us?
I spent a lot of time talking with kids and you know, doing library programs and you know, community programs to help kids learn about things like frogs and bugs and things like that. And what I found was that kids are really interested in that sort of thing up through a certain age. But I think in our culture, we're sort of encouraged to move on from that and to start learning exclusively from books and from teachers instead of keeping an eye on the natural world and what it can teach you. And so I really felt it would be useful for people to know that it's still okay to look around at just, you know, whatever you find in your yard or at the local park or on a nature walk, and that it really will teach you things that you're not likely to learn anywhere else.
We're talking with author Gordon Grice right now. He's the author of Cabinet of Curiosities, Understanding and Collecting and Understanding the Wonders of the Natural World. And Gordon, what are some common things that grown-ups or kids might be able to find that you think would have a good place here in a Cabinet of Curiosity?
I think people should put in anything that interests them, but some of the easy things to find are seashells, for example. So some of the things that I talk about are strike people as gross, and that's fine. But a lot of things that people will find, you know, really appealing aesthetically, like seashells and like flowers. In the book, I talk a little bit about how to preserve those. And seed pods from plants in your area. One of the things that happens to people when they start to look for just interesting things like seed pods and flowers is they suddenly realize that there are hundreds of them around them that they never noticed before. And so it's kind of a really quick way to get in tune with what nature is offering us.
And you write in the book, and you spend some time talking about this, a step two is, after you've got this interesting thing, you've got it in your cabinet, classifying it, trying to figure out where it fits into the natural world. Why is that important next step to take?
I have to say, I don't think it's important. I think, you know, if you just want to look at the thing and be interested in it, that's great. But there is another interesting layer there if you are interested in classifying it. One thing that I tried to do in the book is to show that every living thing is connected. And things don't just exist out there in isolation, but they've all, you know, they all are linked together ultimately. And when you begin to try to classify things, you begin to see the overall patterns of, for example, what type of plants there are in the world. And that leads you to what they actually do. And I think ultimately, if I can sort of preach a bigger message, this kind of helps people see how ecological issues play into this. The more you appreciate the little things in nature, the more you are aware of the bigger issues that we need to be concerned about.
I was thinking about some of the things that I have in my home that would fall under this category. I've got seashells from New Zealand. I have dried flowers. I have rocks from Lake Superior. So what do you think is the benefit of having them all in one place? How does it change the way we think about them?
For me, it's not just having them in one place and leaving them, but sort of playing with them and grouping them in different ways. So, for example, I have a set of animal skulls. And sometimes those go into just a big shelf with all kinds of specimens. But other times they can just be in a row on a shelf with just skulls. And what you see is sort of an automatic lesson in comparative biology. You start to see, you know, how is a fox different than a cat? And their behavior is revealed by their bones. So it's kind of just this lesson. You just sort of learn things without really even trying about what goes on in the world. So it's sort of like a still photo that reveals so much of what actually happened.
Let's get practical, Gordon. Say there's a parent-kid combo out there saying, yeah, we want to try something like this. What are some good things that they can use as their cabinet? Could be the cigar box you mentioned. What are some other handy ways to make that first collection?
In my house, we have old CD cases that we just use for putting whatever we find in there. So that's a real easy place to start. But it could be almost anything. When I was younger, we would get cases from soda pop bottles from the store, and that is sort of just they just had sort of little natural cubby holes that we could use. So just any sort of case or collection, wine boxes, with little individual compartments for the bottles. And you can also, if you're a little more ambitious or a little more handy, you can build a case of your own, kind of depending on what kind of specimens you have that you want to put in there.
Do you have any advice for us on how to preserve this stuff? Some of it, could decay a bit, things like flowers, maybe feathers. What do we need to know about helping it last?
In the book, I talk about different ways to preserve those, and unfortunately, they all have kind of different methods of preservation. But there are ways to do it, and some of the methods involve salting, for example, to take all the moisture out so that rot doesn't happen. With plants, and especially flowers, the old-fashioned way of pressing the specimen between the leaves of an encyclopedia still really works well. And so in the book, we go into methods of handling several different things like that.
We're talking with Wisconsin nature writer and author Gordon Grice. He's making the case for getting out in nature and collecting some of the cool stuff that you find out there and starting your own cabinet of curiosities.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you ever done something like this? Had your own cabinet of curiosities, even if you maybe didn't use that phrase? Is this something you did as a kid, something you do with your kids now? And what kind of things have you found and added to that collection? What's the coolest thing you've found in nature and brought back? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking to Gordon Grice. He's from Wisconsin. He's the author of Cabinet of Curiosities. And we're talking about the joy of getting out into nature, collecting some natural items, things like shells, fossils, seed pods, that sort of thing, and displaying them, too, along the way.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Is this something that you do with your family? Do you have your own sort of cabinet of curiosities? And what's in it? What is the coolest thing that you've ever found that really makes you think about the natural world and our place in it? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll go right to a caller. We've got Lynn on the line in Bayview. Lynn, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
What do you want to tell us about, Lynn?
Well, I feel so much of a kindred spirit to Gordon because I started collecting when I was very, very young. I was so young. But I would make my mother save pimento jars or any very small jars. And wherever I would go, I would take a little teaspoon and collect the soil sample. It could be sand. It could be just soil. But whenever we loaded up in the station wagon, I was sure to have a teaspoon and a bunch of pimento jars so I could collect soil samples and sand samples from all over the country. And then I'd come home and I'd arrange them on my shelf in my bedroom. And it was just so fascinating. And I learned so much about geology, just the different combinations of minerals on the surface of the earth that get worn down by erosion or water, air, whatever, wind. But it was totally fascinating, and I thought I was the only person. So I'm so happy that Gordon shares that need to collect.
And Lynn, I got to ask, do you still do anything like this now?
Well, yes, actually, that early entrance into geology, it's encouraged a passion in what we do with the Earth's crust. So pottery making, glass making. I'm very, very interested in collecting great works of manipulated earth sediment materials.
Thank you so much, Lynn. Very interesting. So Gordon, soil samples is part of our cabinet of curiosity. And what she said that reminded me of something you said, having all these things side by side helps us learn about them.
Yeah, and I just want to tell Lynn that one of the really great experiences of my life was visiting the lab of a forensic scientist who had probably kind of the ultimate version of what she's talking about, soil samples from thousands of locations. And in his case, he was using it to solve crimes because he could tell, for example, wherever in the country a certain vehicle had driven, because he had the soil samples to compare with the soil that was recovered from the wheel well of a car. And so it was this really amazingly practical use for what I'm sure started as something just like what she was doing. And he, with microscopes, could tell amazing stories about what happened in the areas where each sample was collected.
Well, Lynn, thanks a lot for that call. And Gordon, something I want to make sure we talk about is the stuff that you can't collect. I know things like eagle feathers you're not supposed to take, and maybe the same is true for other things like bird's nests. How do we know what it is okay to pick up for our collection and what we need to leave in the ecosystem?
The best approach, I think, is to call up wherever you're going to collect and call the authorities, so the DNR, for example. If you go into federal parklands, for example, basically everything is supposed to stay where it is, even bones, because they're part of the ecosystem and they return nutrients to that system. But if you simply phone up the agency that's in charge of that, ask them what things are okay to collect and what things need to be left where they are, that's probably the best approach.
Back to our callers now with Jackie in Milwaukee. Jackie, hi.
Hi. I remember from my grade school days many, many years ago that they had a project where the kids had to go out and gather fall leaves and identify the tree or plant they came from, and then we preserved them between sheets of wax paper and then built a notebook of them. And what it did was help kids early on develop an interest in biology and how you go about it, identifying what a plant is in nature. And I thought it was a great project. And in the end, you had a really beautiful notebook, too.
Jackie, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Gordon, a classic there, the leaf collection.
Yeah, that's back in history. They called that the herbarium. When you make an actual book out of it. And, again, it's just such a wonderful tool for learning, exactly like Jackie said. You can get easy, handy guides that help you kind of go through the steps of how to identify a leaf and tell what tree it came from.
We're talking to Gordon Grice. His new book is Cabinet of Curiosities, Collecting and Understanding the Wonders of the Natural World. He's making the case that, hey, kids, and maybe not just kids, should go out, collect stuff, maybe even in your own backyard. Find interesting, curious stuff and display it. A cigar box, a cabinet, what have you. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. Do you do anything like this? Do you have a collection of your own, or did you? 800-642-1234.
And Gordon, when you get one of these really cool specimens, it sounds like part of it is the specimen itself and how cool it is to learn about it and hold it and look at it. And part of it is the finding. When you look at your own cabinet, what piece from your collection really stands out as being one that was really exceptional?
Wow, there are so many. I have this is another one that I'm not going to suggest that kids try on their own, but I have a set of egg sacs from black widow spiders. And
wow.
This is one of those that a lot of people think is terribly gross. But it's very interesting to me because of the landscape where I collected them, and I had to learn how where the spiders live, what kind of shapes of things they like to get into, for example, car tires. And then when I collected them, I kept them as live specimens for a few years. And, of course, spiders don't live long lives, but they do leave behind these interesting artifacts that you can collect.
Wow, so what does a black widow egg sac look like?
It's about the size of a marble, and it's made out of what looks like cotton or maybe even linen, depending on the species. So it's a very fine, round sort of thing, but big enough to examine closely.
We'll go back to our callers with George in Brookfield now. George, hi.
Hi. Well, not necessarily natural, more archaeology. I have an arrowhead collection where I would find arrowheads when I was a kid behind my house where I grew up in Missouri. And they've always fascinated me, you know, to think of how they were made. Some are perfectly symmetrical, and you'd be hard-pressed to see that they weren't somehow machine-made or something. They're just perfect arrowheads. So I've always been enthralled with those.
George, thanks a lot for that call. So, Gordon, human-made stuff, and I could see, depending on where you live, colonial era or 19th century human-made stuff being an interesting part of a cabinet of curiosities, too.
Yeah, I had childhood experiences really similar to George's, collecting arrowheads with my grandmother, and especially in areas where the Dust Bowl was a big part of the ecology back in the 1930s, which is long before my time. But it had left this effect of having blown away so much soil that artifacts like arrowheads were easy to find. So it was just such a learning opportunity, first about how the structure of the stone that allows them to be sort of machined by hand, as George was saying, and secondly about the culture that made them, and then thirdly about the climate change that caused them to be brought back to view for a later generation.
And Gordon, just very briefly, anything still on your list to collect?
The whole world is still on my list. I don't know that I need to actually have it in my cabinet, but I there's so many things I'd love to photograph, from interesting kinds of geodes to bones to tropical plants.
Well, thanks so much for joining us and telling us about it today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
That was Gordon Grice, a Wisconsin-based nature writer and author of the new book, Cabinet of Curiosities, Collecting and Understanding the Wonders of the Natural World.
Now, coming soon to a galaxy not so very far away, it's the next Star Wars movie.
This one is called The Force Awakens. It's kind of hard for me to figure out where we are chronologically in the trilogy, but I think this is what happens after The Return of the Jedi. Mm-hmm. It picks up there. So this is not the Jar Jar Binks era.
And that's okay. Tickets will be sold starting tonight after the release of a new trailer. Here's a listen to a bit of the last trailer that got released.
The Force is strong in my family. My father has it. I have it. My sister has it. You have that power too.
So it sounds like another generation of Jedi being trained there in the coming movies. We're both Star Wars nerds.
Yeah. But one thing I think fans are excited about, old school fans, yeah, not the newer generations, is I believe that I heard that Harrison Ford,
yep,
and Chewie have
Chewbacca
cameos in the next one.
Mark, yeah, Hamill as Luke Skywalker,
Hamill, yeah,
of course. Yeah. So are you excited, though? Because I've been burned before. I'll believe,
yeah,
it when I see it.
Yeah, you're right. I'm approaching it with tentative,
optimism.
Guarded optimism.
All right. Well, people are excited. Tickets on sale tonight. I will not be buying them tonight. I'll wait till the theaters are less crowded and probably check it out. You?
I think I'll hold on too. See what reviews come in.
All right. Stick around. More to come here on Central Time.